Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. When Pulse reporter Sojourner Ahebe has a question about her family history, she knows exactly where to turn, her mother. And some of that history is on display in their house.
In fact, at the entry of our home, when you come in our home, it's all the ancestors on the wall.
That's my mom, Octavia McBride. She got her knack for sleuthing when she was a news reporter in the late 80s. And every time I had an assignment for school that involved family history, she was the person I went to.
Yeah, and I was excited because I felt like I was passing the baton to you because I was always sort of like the person collecting the pictures and the stories. So I get great strength and pride from knowing my family stories, sharing them and passing them along to my own children and my nieces and nephews.
And Sojourner, does your mom do her research with paper records or how does she go about it?
Yeah, it's been a mix of paper records and stories she's heard over the years from relatives. So for example, my mom was actually able to piece together the story of her grandmother, Della May.
She had my mother, Sally, by a white man. And of course, in 1931, those types of relationships and the children that came from them, they were illegal. So the white family, who was pretty prominent, placed my mother in the home of a sort of fair-skinned family where my mother would not stick out.
So Sally, my grandmother, was raised in this family, and eventually their children migrated to Philadelphia for work and to escape some of the racial violence of the South.
And how far back can your mom trace your family history? What year, roughly?
Sure. So the oldest ancestor that we actually know of by name would have been around the mid-19th century. But to go further back, it's a little bit more complicated. During slavery, African-American families were constantly being separated from one another. So it was really common for you not to have been raised by your biological parents. So that makes it really hard to find biological ancestors. And the U.S. Census, which is the most widely used record in genealogy research, didn't actually record African Americans by name until after the Civil War in 1870. So if you want to go further back than that and find out more details, paper documents will only take you so far. And some people have called this the wall of slavery.
Is DNA research helpful at all in finding out more details when you hit that wall?
So yes and no, they have and they haven't. They can help you find relatives and tell you whether you have ancestry from particular regions in the world, like Africa or Asia. But for many people, they can't really answer those deeper questions like who your ancestors were, their names, and their customs.
And that hits on the limitations of DNA itself. I mean, there's only so much DNA can tell us, but that promise is further limited by how samples are collected and who participates in that research. On today's show, we'll take a look at what DNA research reveals and who benefits from it. To get started, more on this topic of what DNA tests can and cannot tell you about your family history and ancestry, and the wall that many African American families hit when they are trying to do this kind of research. Here's Sojourner Ahebe.
At Westchester University near Philadelphia, students can participate in a class called the DNA Discussion Project. It's designed to get students to talk about their family histories, their identity, and they take a DNA test to see how genetics fits into that family story.
Everybody talks about their ancestry. Everybody talks about their family tree.
Anita Foman is a professor of communications who founded this project, and she says African-American students face a unique set of challenges in doing this work.
And in effect, many Black students hit that wall of slavery. And so they are really looking to see if they can extend their understanding of their family.
Amari Gilmore participated in the project when she was a student. She knew a good bit about her family's history going into the class, thanks to her great aunt Christine, who had shared some stories about their ancestors and their lives in the South.
They were farmers, and the land that they worked in West Virginia, and how they had accumulated small pockets of wealth here and there, and how all of kind of our family has gone out and really sought education. A lot of my family, they are educators, but that's been a passed down kind of trait, if you will, from even as far back as in slave times.
What she had hoped for with the DNA test were some more specific details about her ancestors and to expand on some of the family stories.
So on my mother's side, they have a lot more pictures of just relatives. And there is this claim that we are part Native American, and that there were several ancestors of mine that had that long, straight, black hair, definitely also told that I was a descendant of slaves.
When Amari got her DNA test back, the results really surprised her.
It told me I was 80% African, 20% European, not at all Native American. I was kind of shocked to see such a high percentage of European ancestry, and was kind of shocked, but not really, that there was no Native American in me.
Anita said it's common for African Americans to overestimate Native American ancestry. It can be a way to mitigate painful memories of slavery, particularly sexual violence Black enslaved women endured from their white slave owners.
When I found out that I was 20% European, I'm like, does this affect me? And then I was like, no, I'm still a Black person.
Amari had also hoped to get some answers from this test in terms of geography, where in Africa her ancestors were from. Her test results pointed to Ghana and the Ivory Coast as the top two countries within her African ancestry percentage. And those are countries on the coast of the continent where many Africans were kidnapped and put on ships to the Americas. But this gets us to one of the major limitations of DNA tests. We want them to tell us who we are and where we are from. But the where is especially tricky. To understand why, you have to look at how these tests work. To begin with, we all have DNA in every cell of our bodies. 99.9% of every human's DNA is the same.
In that 0.1% of our DNA is where our differences lie. Our hair texture, our skin color, our height, our weight, our personality. Ancestry can be found in those differences.
That's Gina Page. She's the co-founder of AfricanAncestry.com, a genealogy company that was started with the express purpose of helping people of African descent answer questions about their roots. She says there are single letter changes in that 0.1% of our DNA called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs for short. These are passed down from generation to generation, which means geneticists can compare your SNPs to a genetic database of people with known ancestries to estimate your own ancestry.
If we can query a group of people in Africa, analyze their genetic signatures on the part of the DNA that does not change over time, then we can say if your DNA looks like this, it's probably shared with the Fulani people. If your DNA looks like this, it's probably shared with the Mandinka.
But for Black Americans, the size and diversity of the database really matters. Most of the major DNA companies have databases where people of European ancestry are overrepresented. In 2018, 23andMe could only match people to three broad regions in sub-Saharan Africa. So if you're Black, you're not going to get very specific results. For example, imagine you share genetic ancestry with people from a small town in Ghana. If the testing companies have a bunch of people from that small town, they can match you against them really effectively. But if they don't have people from that specific small town, they might just determine you're broadly West African. But the big DNA companies are trying to diversify these databases. For example, 23andMe now has a program called the Global Genetics Project, where they invite people from undersampled regions of the world to donate their saliva in exchange for free test results. Gina says AfricanAncestry.com is ahead of the game in that case because they have the largest database of African samples in the world.
We have a mother and a father. We each inherit 50% of our DNA from our mother and 50% from our father. So if your mother's yellow and your father's blue, then you're going to be green. Imagine that you're green, but you have a little yellow dot. That's DNA that you inherited from your mother that didn't mix with your father. It stayed yellow. That's called mitochondrial DNA.
So African ancestry looks at either the mitochondrial DNA you inherited from your mother or the Y chromosome men inherit from their fathers, and then trace it back to a present-day African country or ethnic group.
That means that our answer that we give you for that question of where were my people before the transatlantic slave trade and who were my people? How did they live? What were their cultures, cultural practices, their traditions, their values, their beliefs? You can get that answer when you know the tribe.
But the vast majority of genetic reference groups are based on people who self-report their ancestry. So while someone might be really sure that they are a specific ethnicity or that their family came from a specific place, that knowledge is often incomplete and therefore not an accurate measure of ancestry. And this gets to the bigger question of what these tests are really looking for. Ethnicity is a sociocultural factor. It's fluid. It changes over time. It's not purely biological. Most people have multiple ethnic and ancestral backgrounds, which means the DNA tests most likely won't be able to capture the whole breadth of your story. And the companies don't just match you to one geographical area or region in the world. They assign you very specific percentages.
If you remember the yellow dot we spoke, they then send the codes for your maternal ancestry or your paternal ancestry to our analysis team, which is made up of geneticists. And the analysis team then does the comparison of your DNA to DNA around the world to determine the ancestry.
So an ancestry DNA test might reveal you have 80% African ancestry and 20% European ancestry. That just means a geneticist ran your DNA in an algorithm with the reference DNA and said, let's try to put known ancestries together in different combinations to get a similar variation of SNPs that you have. In other words, the computer is looking for a best fit, not a perfect match. And Gina agrees. DNA holds a lot of valuable clues, but it can't tell the full story. She says there are just some things slavery took that aren't salvageable.
Psychologists have shown that knowing where you're from is a critical component of knowing who you are. We don't know our original names. We don't know our original languages. We don't even know who many of our family members really are because of the disconnection, the intentional, masterful disconnection of people that slavery required. We are the descendants of people who walk through life not being able to answer a simple question. And if you think about it, it's a question that people talk about all the time.
The test can't tell you your ancestor's name, what they like to wear, that song they used to sing. But even without those details, your DNA carries a resilient record of all that you came from.
Even though we don't know the names, and even though we don't know the languages, and even though we don't know our family trees, and we'll never know those, we have the actual DNA from somebody who made it through that entire horrific history of capture, being packed on a slave ship, plantation living, no humanity, can't get married, you can't keep your children, you're not allowed to read and write, segregation, Jim Crow, you name it. Somebody's DNA made it through all of that.
For The Pulse, I'm Sojourner Ahebe.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com. The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about DNA. Before our break, we heard a story from Sojourner Ahebe about some of the limitations of DNA when it comes to geography and telling us where exactly our ancestors were from. A lot of genetic data comes from people of white European ancestry, and many groups are either not represented in DNA databanks at all, or they are underrepresented. This doesn't just affect ancestry research, of course. It also has implications for drug development, medical advances, and on and on. There's long been an idea that sharing our DNA for research is for the greater good, that it leads to new insights, new medications, and discoveries. But that part hasn't come true for many people, who in turn have felt reluctant to participate in DNA collection efforts. Alan Yu has this story about DNA research and who stands to benefit.
Crystal Soucy wanted to become a doctor as a kid, to understand how science could make a difference in treating disease. She got a research job in cancer biology, developing treatments.
I could just see myself in the laboratory late at night in my 70s, applying drugs to plates of cells.
But as a member of the Navajo Nation, there was this one thought that she could not shake.
Even if I were to be successful in creating a successful drug regimen for treating cancer, would this therapy actually translate to benefiting my own people, my own Indigenous communities? And I just had the thought that that probably wouldn't be the case.
She thought even if she kept working in the lab, developed a cancer drug that made it through clinical trials, that drug would most likely be too expensive for most patients back at her home to afford. The Indian Health Service, which the Navajo Nation relies on, is deeply underfunded compared to Medicare and Medicaid, and has been for many years.
So, you know, there's a huge barrier to accessing adequate healthcare. I didn't really want to exacerbate that by putting all my efforts into creating something that wouldn't translate to them.
Crystal left her career in cancer biology and went into genetics instead.
Genomics was experiencing this growth in sequencing technologies, and sequencing was generating all this new data that needed to be interrogated and studied. And there was a huge drive for increasing diversity of types of populations that were represented in these data sets. But there really weren't any people that looked like me who was on the side of researchers.
And the lack of representation in research matters. There is a long history of outside scientists treating marginalized populations unjustly, leaving them reluctant to take part in further research.
A lot of these ethical dilemmas were thought of like at the turn of the last century. We just think that they're new today because we're actually now confronted with the realities of where this technology can take us. But it annoys me that scientists are thinking that this is somehow a new question.
For example, the Havasupai tribe in Arizona got a $700,000 settlement from Arizona State University in 2010 because of improper research protocols. Researchers took blood samples from the Havasupai tribe for DNA tests, but did not tell them that the tests could be used for studying a variety of conditions. The tribe had asked for help studying diabetes, but the consent form was so broad it allowed research into mental illness and inbreeding, unbeknownst to the research participants. The Navajo Nation banned genetic research on tribal land in 2002. Crystal is now the Ethics and Policy Director for the Native Biodata Consortium, a repository of genetics data led by Indigenous scientists and tribal members. Her message to other Indigenous people is that they can choose not to take part in research if they don't want to.
they hold the cards in terms of power here. Scientists have interests, and sometimes commercial interests, in accessing our genomic information. So we really should be exercising our sovereignties in order to ensure that any research partnership that we undertake or become a part of is something that we can stand to benefit from.
This challenges the assumption from geneticists that genetics data should be shared freely and openly. The promise of genomic research is knowledge and medicine that benefits all of humanity. That studying the small genetic differences between humans of specific populations could lead to new discoveries. One example is how studying the DNA of people of African ancestry led to the development of PCSK9 inhibitors, a game-changing cholesterol drug. Thus, the argument that it is just a purely good thing to give DNA to scientists freely, and that expectation was there from the start.
We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey of the entire human genome. Without a doubt, this is the most important, most wondrous map ever produced by humankind.
That was US President Bill Clinton at the White House in 2000 to announce that scientists had completed a working draft of the human genome sequence. At the time, one of the biggest concerns was that one of the scientists who did the sequencing work in the private sector would patent or own part of the human genome. And so scientists from the US, UK, Europe, and Japan agreed to share. But Crystal says it's a little more nuanced than that.
The information from Human Genome Diversity Project and also other similar large-scale diversity projects were made openly available to researchers to, quote, democratize genomics. I hate that word, democratizing.
Because democracy implies equity, all parties involved sharing the risks and the rewards. But Crystal says that is not the case.
The American system of democracy will always benefit the majority, and that system will always disenfranchise small underrepresented populations. So it kind of annoys me when that word democratize is used as a synonym for equity, when in reality, it just means continual disenfranchisement of minority voices.
Specifically, marginalized populations often do not get a seat at the table alongside the scientists who want to study them. Keolu Fox is a native Hawaiian genome scientist and an assistant professor at the University of California, San Diego.
Currently, the status quo is to create a research partnership with a community, potentially from a geographically isolated area, you know, give them an Amazon gift card or a bag of rice or a bag of coffee and have them basically spit in a tube or give you blood or access to their genome and their biomaterial, their DNA. That is then sequenced, and then mutations are identified in that specific population.
Once the drugs go through the stages of development, scientists have no obligation to share the proceeds and treatments with the people who were studied. Jenny Reardon is a sociologist and a scholar of science and technology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She says we can see the problem with this most clearly from a less well-known project of the 1990s, the Human Genome Diversity Project.
So this had long been the dream, and the idea was that if you wanted to understand human evolution, you know, what causes evolution? Is it drift? Is it selection? What are the forces at work? Then you want to be able to look at the structure of the human gene pool as it looked when the human species evolved. And the idea was that indigenous populations held that secret.
The project would collect and sequence DNA samples from indigenous populations around the world. Scientists back then dreamed of the promise these results would hold, including Jenny herself.
Yeah, the promise of the project was to bridge the humanities and the sciences, to have scientists working alongside historians and anthropologists ask deep questions about what does it mean to be human. And it also promised to challenge concepts of race and to fight racism. And I just thought, absolutely, this is what I want.
But as she studied the Human Genome Diversity Project as a sociologist, she saw some problems emerge. One problem was that the scientists involved in the Human Genome Diversity Project had this whole plan for gathering DNA samples from people around the world. But they did not ask the people around the world if they wanted this done to them.
The project belatedly decided it needed an ethics component, and this is a trend. Unfortunately, a lesson that has not been particularly learned well is that you need ethics from the very beginning of a project.
Indigenous groups around the world did not like this. And they also did not like how the project leader, a population geneticist called Luca Cavalli-Sforza, described the chance to study them as, quote, a vanishing opportunity. He wrote an article about the project in the journal Genomics, saying that, quote, such isolated human populations are being rapidly merged with their neighbors, however, destroying irrevocably the information needed to reconstruct our evolutionary history. Here's what Crystal Soucy sees in that line.
They wanted to sample as many indigenous populations worldwide before we disappeared, which is colonial in the utmost sense of the world.
Specifically, the language implies that indigenous populations were akin to specimens to be studied before they were gone, as opposed to people who have futures. Luca Cavalli-Sforza died in 2018. I asked one of his colleagues and partners in the Human Genome Diversity Project, Marcus Feldman, a biologist at Stanford, about that criticism.
When we look around the world today and see that the number of minority groups in different parts of the world that are being oppressed, trying to reconstruct the history of the world, when some of the groups that may have been important in that history of the world will no longer be the way they were. That's, I think, what Luca was trying to get at.
He says colonialism was exactly what they were against. One of their goals was to disprove racism, provide further evidence that humans are almost all genetically the same, and we can come together as one. Here we have proof of it from our genomes. And he points out this is work that will benefit humans overall.
The availability of those large data sets is critical to the progress that is being made, both from what I consider to be the anthropological context and the medical context.
But the backlash took hold. Some critics described it as the vampire project. When I asked Marcus what lessons he thought the experience could hold for future researchers, he said the scientists did not do a good enough job of explaining what they were doing. And perhaps they could have had some kind of public health focus beyond the more abstract goal of studying human prehistory. But by the time they realized this, it was too late. Here's Jenny Reardon again.
I think from the perspective of the National Science Foundation, like what they had given the project, you know, funding to do planning workshops for never happened. They were going to go and collect samples from around the world. That never happened.
We're listening to a story by Alan Yu about DNA research, who participates in it and why, and who stands to benefit. Coming up, the lasting consequences of that ambitious effort to collect DNA from people around the world.
These controversies were very consequential to the people who were involved, and it left scars that impacted the field.
That's next on The Pulse.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about genetic research, who benefits from it, and whether people should share their genetic data for the greater good. Before our break, reporter Alan Yu walked us through the Human Genome Diversity Project. It was an ambitious effort that started in the 1990s. The idea was to collect and study DNA from indigenous communities all over the world to learn about human evolution and hopefully contribute to medical advances. But controversy erupted over ethical implications in collecting these samples and getting consent from the people who were participating. And because of that, the project never fully got off the ground. Here's Alan.
What the scientists could do in the end was sequence DNA samples that already existed from populations around the world and make that data publicly available. That data continues to be used. For example, last year, researchers published a study in the journal Science based on this dataset, and they say they identified previously unknown gene variants. Also, 23andMe uses that data in their reference database because it helps them diversify their data sources. But sociologist Jenny Reardon says in terms of ethical issues, the Human Genome Diversity Project lives on in infamy.
These controversies were very consequential to the people who were involved, for the bioethicists who were involved, for the program officers at the NIH, for the scientists themselves who got critiqued for supporting a colonialist racist project. They do not forget that. And it left scars that impacted the field.
Jenny says geneticists did not really learn their lesson from all this. As part of one of her book projects, she spoke to a geneticist who was trying to do a similar project for National Geographic, and she asked him,
you know, have you consulted with any of these groups or anything? And he said, no, we haven't. We wouldn't want to invite people to the party before we knew there was a party. And this is a mistake that's made over and over again. The idea, oh, we just got to get the logistics on the ground first and, you know, figure out the technical stuff first, and then we'll figure out the ethics.
And what geneticists did take away is, in Jenny's opinion, the wrong lesson.
Well, we're not going to collect from indigenous peoples. We understand that they don't want to take part. That was not their critique. They weren't saying, leave us alone. They were saying, you need to consult with indigenous peoples and their governments and work with them. And they might want to be involved, but you need to speak with them.
This 30-year-old project has parallels to more recent projects. Fast forward now to 2015. President Barack Obama is giving his State of the Union address.
So tonight I'm launching a new precision medicine initiative to bring us closer to curing diseases like cancer and diabetes, and to give all of us access to the personalized information we need to keep ourselves and our families healthy. We can do this.
It was the one moment in his State of the Union address in which there was applause across the aisles. There was still that dream, right? The turn of the millennium dream. Population geneticists, you know, were claiming, look, that genomics can demonstrate that we're all the same and it can help bring us together and it can help do great things for the human species.
That led to what is now called the All of Us program from the National Institutes of Health. The idea was, again, to look at the small differences between people to find better and more targeted treatments. To study those smaller differences, scientists need to gather DNA and lifestyle data from people across the country to figure out how could medicine work best for everyone.
The right set of data on a very diverse set of people who live in this country can help us uncover things about, you know, the health and disease spectrum that we haven't even thought of yet.
That's Stephanie Devaney, Chief Operating Officer for All of Us at the NIH. She says researchers have learned some lessons from past experiences like the Human Genome Diversity Project.
The ethos of the research world had changed quite a bit from the day in which we used to call people human subjects, including in the regulations, to the present day in which we think of these as participants, as partners. These are the people who are donating, myself included, I'm a participant in the study, who are donating their data to, you know, help improve the health of their community or the country as a whole.
The program collected data from people who consented in an ongoing process that they could withdraw from at any time. But there are still problems. For example, the program collected data from people who self-identified as Native Americans before consulting with tribal nations about the project.
When it was, you know, pretty much a sprint from the start, but from the community perspective, we could have started having the conversations even earlier than we did.
The All of Us program has since done more work with tribal nations, and the work continues. This March, they released a report about the consultations they had done with tribal nations and how they would change their research going forward. Among the changes, All of Us is not releasing any data from self-identified Native Americans until they have had a chance to consult with tribal governments. So what was it that all of these well-intentioned researchers were missing?
If you're a research scientist, you tend to want to take charge of conversations. You want to lead the conversation. It's just sort of part of our instinct.
That's Kenneth Thummel, a professor of pharmaceutics at the University of Washington, who has done a lot of research with Alaska Native communities.
To build a partnership, it's necessary to step back and listen.
That may sound simple and kind of obvious. But Kenneth said that took years of work of just showing up and listening to people about what they wanted to establish a fruitful, trusting relationship. And that can be an adjustment.
Taking a secondary role, letting them be the primary drivers of the research. You know, I found that to be very challenging, but also very, very gratifying.
Denise Dillard works with him on a lot of research projects. She's the Director of Research for the South Central Foundation, an Alaska Native healthcare system which provides healthcare and does research.
You would never barge up to somebody's house, knock on the door, and kind of come in and make yourself comfortable. There's been a history in many communities where in Alaska we call it helicopter research. You know, a researcher may come in kind of from the outside, collect data, specimens, and then kind of leave, and then they're never heard from.
She worked on research with Kenneth, and that took about a decade's worth of engagement.
Asking the community questions about research itself and, you know, would you contribute biological specimens? We weren't sure what people would think about that. Researchers need to demonstrate that they really do care about the community and that it's not about them building their own credentials or getting more funding, but they really seem to have a genuine motivation to really help the community, but not in a paternalistic way. You know, Alaska Native American Indian people don't need to be saved by somebody outside, but there are other experts and other knowledge that really could be beneficial in Native communities. And so how can we better partner together?
She says researchers have to be open to listen to what people want, even if it means changing research questions. Kenneth had gone in with an interest in how people respond to drugs. That's his specialty. But that's not what Denise and their partners were most interested in.
But what they said is, you know, if you could help us address things like obesity or tobacco use, those are the things that we see every day that impact a really large segment of the population.
And so they studied nicotine metabolism. Kenneth was no expert, and they brought on someone who was. They found that there are some people who metabolize nicotine more slowly, so it stays in their body longer, which means that if they want to quit smoking, nicotine replacement therapy could be a good choice for them. Whereas for the people who metabolize nicotine and clear it from their body more quickly, perhaps a drug would be a better choice. Denise said that the South Central Foundation designs research with the goal of making the benefits accessible to the people in their studies.
We don't really even consider doing research within the department that I lead unless it's going to be something that is A, like an important health priority, and B, that there is some sort of benefit that is going to come out of it.
And all the data from their research lives in a specimen bank in Alaska, jointly managed by the tribes and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They own their own data. The tricky bit about this is time and research funding. It can be hard to tell research funders to give a decade's worth of money to build trust in communities and work with them on research questions.
When we go in for research applications, our competitors are the Yales and the Harvards and all of these academic research powerhouses. We're very much in the process of building our research infrastructure, but that is one of the real challenges of trying to get more Alaska Native people and American Indian people really leading research.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. We're talking about DNA research and who stands to benefit from it. Our next story is about a closed-off community that has completely bought into utilizing DNA analysis after major initial hesitations. Hesitations despite the fact that a deadly disease was sowing heartache among their families. It's called Tay-Sachs, and it's a devastating neurological disorder that especially impacted ultra-Orthodox Jewish people. Until somebody from their own community found a way to protect them as well as their traditions. Let's listen back to this story Jad Slayman reported a few years ago.
Hello, and thank you for calling Doria Sharon, the International Committee for the Prevention of Jewish Genetic Diseases.
If you're a member of the more conservative Jewish Orthodox communities, you know, black hats, religious devotion, an old-fashioned dress code, you probably recognize this automated phone service. For the rest of you, Dor Yeshorim is Hebrew for upright generation. Young Orthodox Jews give him a call before they get married.
For compatibility requests, press 1.
That's right. Call a hotline, plug in some numbers, and the service rates you and your significant other as compatible, or if both of you happen to be carriers for a genetic disease, not compatible. Sorry, keep looking. Unfortunately, the hotline is about as far as I got trying to talk to the organization. Dor Yeshorim is exceptionally private, serving a closed community. The people at their Brooklyn headquarters were kind and polite, but they seemed wary of secular media like, well, The Pulse. So instead, I decided to backtrack. Why are some genetic disorders so common among Ashkenazi Jews in the first place? I headed up to the Bronx to meet medical geneticist Harry Osterer at his lab.
Do you mind just walking us?
Yeah, sure. Sure.
The first thing I noticed is a sheet of paper taped to the fridge.
This says Roman teeth, so that's
Roman teeth.
Roman teeth.
In a bag?
In a bag, right.
Harry studies the distant genetic origin of diseases, and he thinks these teeth may hold some clues. His book is called Legacy, A Genetic History of the Jewish People.
Oh, can we see the teeth?
I don't think I've unpacked them, but it's actually very cool. Important that we not unpack it because we don't want to contaminate it with modern DNA.
Harry has samples like these from all over the world. He thinks his Romans may have also been Jews.
It's estimated that perhaps 1 in 10 members of the Roman Empire was Jewish.
This was about 2,100 years ago. Then, over the next 2,000 years, came a series of what Harry calls bottlenecks. These are instances where Jewish populations were drastically reduced. There's the fall of the Roman Empire, then the rise of Christianity, and the start of rabbinical Judaism, which made communities more closed off. As a result, today's Ashkenazi Jews, basically those of European descent, trace their lineage to a population that may have numbered no more than 350.
Yeah, that's really quite an extraordinary number when you consider today that there may be as many as 10 to 11 million Ashkenazi Jews.
Harry explained that when a new population grows from a smaller offshoot, you lose genetic diversity. It's what geneticists call the founder's effect. Say the carrier trait for Tay-Sachs disease occurred in 1 out of 100 Jews in a community. The community splinters, and 25 Jews move away together, crossing a mountain or a sea, and one of them happens to be that person with the Tay-Sachs gene. If the new, smaller group multiplies into a bigger community, it does so with a higher incidence of Tay-Sachs carriers than the original population. 1 in 100 becomes 1 in 25.
Now we're still on 42nd Street right now.
New York City, early 70s. Back then, Harry Osterer, our teeth guy, was still a public health student. The Tay-Sachs blood test had just come out, and his class had set up a program to screen for carriers. Around then, he was introduced to patients with Tay-Sachs for the first time.
The Tay-Sachs ward had a lot of babies and young children. They were unaware of their surroundings, blind. They had these pronounced startle responses. They couldn't swallow, so they had to be tube-fed.
With Tay-Sachs, the prognosis is grim.
You know, it's simply a matter of time before these kids are going to die.
You'd think a screening program that prevents that kind of suffering would take off immediately. But Harry only managed to get a few hundred people to take the test. There was stigma, fears about being labeled a carrier, and then never being able to find a partner, never being able to marry and have kids. When two parents do carry the Tay-Sachs variant, any child they have has a 1 in 4 chance of developing the disease. Without a way to curb those odds, and eager to start families, in some observant Orthodox communities, Tay-Sachs continued to strike.
All right, let's get this going.
Okay, sure.
That's Jeremy Berg. We sat down to talk about what family means in communities like this. He's a friend of mine, and he grew up Yeshivish Orthodox in Queens.
I am a general contractor, and I grew up in the Black Hat Orthodox community.
I wanted to learn why screening didn't take off as soon as science made it possible. Jeremy starts by explaining the drive to get married.
I went to over 200 weddings between like 20 and 25.
Later, he left the faith, which is part of the reason he's so comfortable talking to me, but his family still practices.
My other three siblings all went through the shidduch process, the matchmaking process. They went to a matchmaker.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match.
Yeah, that matchmaker. It's a tradition thousands of years old. No one wants Tay-Sachs carrier on their matchmaker resume because the ultimate goal is to have children.
There's a commandment within the 613 positive commandments in the Torah to be fruitful and multiply. Making babies is a good thing. We're supposed to do it.
But there's another aspect to the desire to have lots of kids. An entire community playing catch-up after a devastating genocide.
We're trying to repopulate. If you factor in, like, you know, human inflation for these roughly 7 million Jews that were killed throughout the Holocaust, we could, in theory, be 2/3 larger than we are right now. But there's that classic story of, like, the Hasidic dude walking down the street with, like, his 42 children, and someone's like, when is that going to be enough? He said, when I have 6 million.
That's what the medical community was up against when they were trying to get people to take the screening test. And anything that could possibly impede that, like carrier stigma, was going to be a tough sell. In 1983, it was a Hasidic rabbi, Joseph Eckstein, who finally found a way. He'd lost 4 kids to Tay-Sachs, and after that, vowed to get his fellow Jews to accept screening. Here's how he did it. Just don't tell people they're carriers. If no one knows their status, there's no stigma, and no one has to worry about carrier status affecting their son or daughter's marriage prospects. Instead, the man and woman are rated together, as a couple, either compatible or not. They're never told why or why not, and all of this is done without names.
You will need to submit both the male's and female's 9-digit Dor Yeshorim identification number.
By 1997, the Tay-Sachs ward in Brooklyn, the one with the babies and toddlers, it was practically empty. It's closed now, not enough cases left to treat. But the Tay-Sachs screening was just a simple blood enzyme test. As genetic information technology roared into high gears in the 90s, the Dor Yeshorim panel expanded to more than a dozen diseases.
For Sephardi testing, press 2. To order the optional Ashkenazi panel of tests, press 3.
High school kids today in Orthodox communities have Dor Yeshorim screening days, where girls and boys line up to give blood samples. It's such an everyday part of Orthodox life that teenagers even posted rap videos on YouTube about it.
Did Dor Yeshorim, cause I got Dor Yeshorim, cause I got Dor Yeshorim, cause I did Dor Yeshorim. Hey, hey, my chosen dinner too. Hey, hey.
That story was reported by Jad Slayman. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Sojourner Ahebe is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.